Former Governor Janet Napolitano once talked about Arizona being the Saudi Arabia of solar, but the picture has since become a lot more complicated. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about how competitive Arizona is with other states. Plus, what's the impact of Solar City's move to relocate a number of its Arizona employees to other markets? Also, a boxing match hyped as the fight of the century took place over the weekend, but both of the fighters, Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao, have had controversial experiences with women. So whether it's an athlete, actor, or musician, should a person's private life affect how we feel about them as performers? I'll ask psychologist Lawrence Rubin. Plus, an ASU doctoral student has turned her experience with domestic violence into a one-woman show. I'll talk to Laurel Ann Porter. And rain in May isn't very common, but the Valley actually saw thunderstorms this week. What could be next? I'll ask Randy Cervini. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The NFL finds that the New England Patriots probably deflated footballs to gain the advantage in the AFC title game in January. The league released its report today that concluded Patriots personnel likely participated in violations of the playing rules and that the quarterback, Tom Brady, was probably at least generally aware of what was going on. The mayor of Baltimore is asking the Justice Department to look into whether there are patterns of discrimination and excessive force from the city's police department. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch is considering the request.
Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake says the number of complaints about excessive force from police have been going down, but the city still needs federal investigators to step in.
We all know that Baltimore continues to have a fractured relationship between the police and the community. And recent events continue to demonstrate the need to press forward with these reforms.
The Justice Department is looking into whether Freddie Gray's civil rights were violated when Baltimore police took him into custody last month. Rawlings-Blake's request for a broader investigation comes after similar calls from City Council President Jack Young last October. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News, Baltimore.
The Chicago City Council has approved up to $5.5 million of reparations for police torture victims. The crimes date back to the 1970s, 80s, and 90s under Chicago's disgraced former police commander, John Burge. The ordinance also requires a city to provide mental health counseling, job placement, and other services to survivors. In a rare appearance, the council also heard today from the governor of Illinois, who's warning local lawmakers that his state is in such financial straits there's no money to bail out Chicago from its own fiscal crisis. Governor Bruce Rauner pushed for a more business-friendly environment and less union influence. For Chicago to get what it wants, Rauner says Illinois must get what it needs. French investigators say the co-pilot believed to have deliberately crashed a Germanwings plane in March appeared to have practiced a controlled descent on a previous flight the same day. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the crash killed all 150 people on board.
The French Aviation Accidents Bureau says co-pilot Andreas Lubitz set the plane into descent mode 5 times and then righted it in a 4.5 minute period during a flight from Dusseldorf to Barcelona. Returning to Dusseldorf from Barcelona a few hours later, prosecutors believe Lubitz locked the pilot out of the cockpit and descended the plane into the Alps. Wednesday's report said the pilot appeared to have left the cockpit during the earlier flight as well. Investigators say that's when Lubitz repeatedly set the plane into a descent. The drops were not sharp, say analysts, so no one may have noticed. Germanwings parent company Lufthansa said it hasn't had time to analyze the latest data. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Dow is down 123 points at 17,804. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Constant Contact, proud supporter of small businesses and nonprofits. Constant Contact's email marketing works to help organizations promote themselves online, connecting with current and new customers. More at constantcontact.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. One Los Alamos National Lab employee has been released from the hospital. Another is in critical but stable condition after a weekend accident at the nuclear weapons research facility. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert reports.
A lab spokesman says it could take weeks or even months to investigate Sunday's accident. Details of what happened are not being released. Officials say the problem took place when employees were doing maintenance at an electrical substation that provides power to the lab's Neutron Science Center. In all, 9 workers were sent to the hospital. All but the 2 were treated and released the day of the accident. Crews have been able to restore power to parts of the Neutron Science Center, and some of the employees have returned to work. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Carrie Young. Officials with Daimler Trucks North America say the company broke a Guinness World Record last night when it turned the Hoover Dam into a massive movie screen. The company said 60 projectors used 1.17 million lumens to stretch videos onto the surface of the dam. The light emitted was equal to about 1,400 household light bulbs. The presentation was part of the manufacturer's debut of a self-driving semi-truck.
Auditors say personnel at the Albuquerque Police Department bypassed purchasing regulations when buying body cameras from Taser International in 2013. The city's Office of Internal Audit released the report Tuesday, which says former police chief Ray Schultz's work for Taser may have violated city law. An earlier report by the New Mexico State Auditor uncovered a cozy relationship involving Taser and Schultz. The state review found Schultz disregarded and circumvented the city's process for competitive contracts in the nearly $2 million deal for body cameras and video storage software awarded to Arizona-based Taser.
KJZZ is supported by Maricopa Corporate College, providing a single point of contact for Arizona employers for market-relevant, customized solutions and training programs. More information at maricopacorporate.com.
Looking for partly sunny skies today in the valley, a high near 88 degrees. It's going to be sunny again tomorrow, a high in the mid-80s as well. It's mostly sunny and 83 degrees right now at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, whether it's an athlete, actor, or musician accused of violence or illegal drug use, should a person's private life affect how we feel about them as performers? I'll ask psychologist Lawrence Rubin. Plus, a former ASU doctoral student has turned her experience with domestic violence into a one-woman show. I'll talk to Laureland Porter about her piece, How Not to Make Love to a Woman. Also, rain in May isn't very common, but the Valley actually saw thunderstorms this week. What could be next? I'll ask Randy Cervini, professor of geographical science at ASU. We start today's program with the solar industry in Arizona. Controversy has surfaced over a rate request from Arizona Public Service and a move by Salt River Project to raise solar-related fees. And last week, Solar City announced it was relocating a number of workers out of Arizona in response to SRP's actions. We'll hear from SRP in a few minutes. But first, I turn to Sean Gallagher, Vice President of State Affairs for the Solar Energy Industry Association. Sean, how significant is Solar City's announcement?
I think that's the kind of thing that you're going to see if these policies are successful. We saw similar implications in Ohio last year when they passed some legislation that slowed down the implementation of the renewable portfolio standard. The companies will go to the states where their business is wanted.
Can you generally characterize where you think the state is at in terms of competitiveness right now?
Well, the state's a very attractive solar market. You know, obviously, a lot of sun in Arizona and customers in Arizona want solar. Unfortunately, the utilities have been making proposals, rate proposals at the ACC and in SRP's case, you know, doing it on their own, that really will discourage customers from going solar and may prevent solar customers from going solar.
Is this a case where if the state makes the wrong moves now, it could put us way behind?
I do think so. I think that, you know, well, we've already seen this in SRP, for example. I think before SRP made their rate changes in February, they were having maybe 500 residential solar installations a month in their service territory. And since then, between December when they announced the rate change and April 15th, there are only about 500 residential solar installations. No, sorry, there are only 75 residential installations in SRP. So there should have been, at the rate that we were seeing last year, about 2,200 installations in SRP this spring. There's only been 75, and that's a direct result of the rate change that they made intended to discourage solar.
Is there any buzz outside in terms of what other states? I mean, is Arizona sort of a lone wolf on this in terms of even considering this at the regulatory level?
These issues are arising in other states as well, and but Arizona, I would say, is sort of the hotbed or the I hate to say leader, but it's where these issues are coming up first and fastest. And so I think from the solar industry's perspective, we want to try to get out ahead of things in Arizona before these kinds of proposals spread to other states.
Are there other states right now that you could cite that seem to be way ahead of the pack, doing well, and also are not necessarily susceptible to some of these regulatory issues?
Well, look, I mean, the examples, I think, are New York and California, where the commissions are trying to look at rate issues and rate design issues in sort of an intelligent and considered fashion. And there may be some changes to rate design generally and rate design for solar in particular. But in New York and in California, we're seeing full proceedings with parties allowed to sort of make all their arguments. And we're seeing the commissions take a close look at all the costs and all the benefits of distributed energy resources so that they can come up with a compensation scheme that's fair. In Arizona, the utilities are taking sort of a sledgehammer approach. They are trying to get the commission to act outside of a rate case, for example, outside of a normal hearing process, and without doing a full and fair consideration of all the costs and benefits.
Sean Gallagher, Vice President of State Affairs for the Solar Energy Industry Association.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In announcing that it would relocate a number of workers out of Arizona, Solar City referenced Salt River Project and blamed SRP's solar rates and fees. With me to talk about that and other topics for a few minutes is Scott Harrelson of SRP. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Steve.
Scott, in addition to asking you about this new report from MIT, I want to make sure I get to that. My first question, though, are SRP's decisions on solar fees going to hurt Arizona's overall competitiveness in the solar market? That seemed to be what Sean Gallagher was indicating.
No, I don't believe so at all. In fact, when you talk about the state of the solar in the Valley, it's important to note that rooftop solar is only one portion of that industry. SRP recently has partnered with S-Power to build a huge solar plant in the East Valley, Sandstone. It's 45 megawatts, about the equivalent of 10,000 rooftop solar units. And that can employ some 180 people, most locally hired, for construction and operation. Locally based First Solar is doing great business both in the U.S. and globally, providing utility-scale solar energy panels and services. And, of course, the huge Abengoa solar power plant in Gila Bend is another example of solar growth in Arizona.
Scott, this new report from MIT's Energy Initiative draws the conclusion that utility-owned projects are a more affordable way to meet renewable energy requirements. What did they say about that? Why?
Well, a good example of that is SRP's agreement to purchase the output of this new Sandstone solar plant in the East Valley, where we are going to get the energy on a 20-year contract, a fixed price of 5.3 cents a kilowatt hour for 20 years. That's an amazing price. It's an economical decision on behalf of our customers. So SRP, we are very interested in solar energy, and we're interested in doing it in an economical fashion so it benefits all of our customers. So we'll get that energy for 20 years at a fixed price that's very economical and will benefit all of our customers.
Scott, you know perception is pretty vital. So can Arizona still be a leader in the field if SRP is even seen as big-footing potential competition?
Well, again, we don't look at this as competition. What SRP's responsibility is to provide low-cost and affordable power to all of our customers. And with the case of distributed generation, what we did is develop a new price plan that aligns our prices with the actual cost of providing power and appropriately recovers the costs incurred from our rooftop solar users who continue to rely on our grid. And in that plan, we provide a tool for both the industry and our customers to adopt technology and a behavior that will continue to allow them to save on their SRP bill.
Scott, moving forward on this, how important is it for government incentives to continue? There's been some criticism that as the government pulls back on that, that's affecting solar as well.
Well, I can't speak on behalf of government. I know that in SRP's case, what we've done is we've removed our new price plan removes the incentive for the solar industry. So we believe, though, and we're confident that the industry will adapt. And without that incentive, as most businesses have to operate in our service territory without incentives, that they'll adopt, and we're confident that they'll continue to grow and thrive in our service territory.
Does SRP have a built-in advantage, considering how long it's been in Arizona? Is that an unfair advantage?
No, I think it's if you look at SRP's contributions to the Valley for more than a century, we've built a reputation that what we do is, as a community-based, not-for-profit utility, we make decisions on behalf of all of our customers. We don't do it on behalf of another industry or anything. It's basically what decisions are we going to make that are in the best economic interests of our customers, and our customers trust us to do that, and we believe that what we've done with this new price structure completely aligns with what our reputation is and how we've acted for the last, well, for more than a century.
And Scott, some of your customers were not that thrilled, though, initially about the fees. Do you think once they get to understand it and once they realize it works, they're going to change their opinion, or is this going to be a fight continuing going on?
Well, we do believe that we did anticipate there would be some slowdown when we first introduced this new price plan. Any industry, when you make a significant price structure change such as this, it might take the industry some time to adapt. But we do believe, and we're confident, that they will do so. And again, you know, for our 15,000 existing solar customers, they were grandfathered. They remain on their current price plans and won't be impacted by the new price plans going forward.
Scott, final question for you. At what point does SRP think that overall this new plan has worked out well? Are you looking in 5-year increments, 10-year increments, looking at the amount of energy used, the amount of customers you have using it?
You know, I think that we're going to look at what are all the technologies that are going to be employed. Our new price plan is agnostic to the technology. It doesn't matter if it's rooftop solar, if it's battery technology, load controllers. There's a lot of very interesting and exciting developments taking place in the distributed energy field, and we believe and will feel that our price plan will accommodate all of those technologies going forward. So we believe in the near future we'll not only see rooftop solar continue to thrive in our service territory, but other technologies as well.
Scott Harrelson of SRP. Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. For another perspective on the current state of solar in Arizona, I'm joined by former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mays, currently an attorney in private practice, also a professor of practice at ASU's O'Connor College of Law. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Great to be with you.
Well, great to have you with us. We've been talking a lot about SRP, but Arizona Public Service, APS, has been criticized for trying to increase rates and fees related to solar. Before we get into some of the specifics, how do you look at where solar is at right now in Arizona?
Well, I suppose the good news in all of this controversy is that solar is really booming in Arizona, and I think that's the result, frankly, of the policies that we put in place in the 2000s that basically said to all the utilities in the state, look, you have got to pay people who produce power from their own rooftop solar systems a fair rate, and that power is worth something, and we thought that the utilities, frankly, should be paying for it, and that policy has spurred the adoption of solar throughout all of these utility service territories, I think, frankly, in a way that even they didn't expect, and I think that's what you're seeing is sort of a bit of a backlash against the rise of solar, especially certainly with regard to these proposals down at the Corporation Commission now, with APS, making a very, very large solar charge request. So that's unfortunate, and we can talk about that. But the good news is that solar has never been better in Arizona, and, you know, we need to work to keep it that way. It didn't get that way, by accident, quite frankly.
Did it get there without big bumps? And I guess I wonder, are we expecting a bumpy ride coming up here?
Well, I mean, certainly if the commission were to adopt some of these proposals being made by APS and other utilities, there would be a huge bump. And that's what I'm most concerned about. And I think you heard that from Sean Gallagher and others. It is most likely, in my mind, that you would see a sharp decrease in the number of solar systems that go in Arizona, and it would, frankly, throw up a huge hurdle to people's ability to go solar, and we don't want to see that happen.
So is this a case, considering that APS is governed by the Corporation Commission, SRP obviously has its own board situation,
Sure.
Are we in a situation here where APS is trying to take advantage of a situation? There are some have been concerned about Arizona's electrical system being basically run by couple of monopolies that customers don't have a choice as to who to go with? Is this a case where APS is trying to take advantage of a power base they've built over the years?
Well, I mean, yeah, and that's the problem, which is they do wield enormous influence. They have the power to make filings when they want to make them. But at the end of the day, the Corporation Commission has the final say, and I think that this commission is going to make a wise decision. They're going to come to a conclusion that I think is right for the state of Arizona. I certainly hope they do. And I think, you know, what they need to do most of all is take their time. There's no rush to decide this issue. There needs to be some process. Frankly, as Sean Gallagher said, it needs to be done in a rate case. It legally needs to be done in a rate case. And the commissioners need to have all the tools available to them to address the issue of costs and benefits. The other thing that needs to happen is we need a real independent study in the state of Arizona of what the benefits and what the costs are of solar. What the utilities are doing right now is they're saying, look, you know, there are all these costs. First of all, they haven't proven those costs up. And secondly, we haven't analyzed the benefits. So it's sort of akin to doing a pros and cons list where you only do the cons. And we need to do the pros, too, with regard to solar and make sure we're making the right decision.
Chris, you led the commission when Arizona's renewable energy standard was implemented. How high should that percentage be now? There was talk about even bringing it back from the goal percentage. Should it? I mean, if, in an ideal world, how high should it be?
Well, I mean, when you look at our surrounding states, Steve, it's clear that Arizona's 15% RPS, renewable portfolio standard, is relatively modest. I mean, it didn't feel that way when we were adopting it back in 2007. Yeah. But then our surrounding states went to 20% and 25%. California's about to go to 50%. So when you look at it that way, obviously, I think we could have a much higher RPS. But I think that you're going to see the adoption of solar, frankly, beyond that RPS. If we don't do things like add solar charges onto people's bills, if we don't penalize people for going solar, then we will be able to keep up with the surrounding states like California, New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado. But if we start, you know, making these decisions where we're assessing fees and charges the way APS and some of the other utilities are asking the Corporation Commission to do, we will definitely fall behind, and we don't want to do that. You know, this is the sunniest state in the country. The vast majority of Arizonans believe we ought to be doing more solar, not less, and we have to try to strive for that.
Chris, final question for you. During the election campaign, in fact, we had you in here with me on election night in November, APS faced withering criticism during last fall's campaign for reportedly spending a lot of money to get preferred candidates elected to different offices. How big a deal do you think that's ultimately going to be? We haven't heard a lot of buzz about it lately, but could that pop up again?
Well, you know, that was, you know, very unfortunate. And I, as you know, I strongly disagreed with APS's decision to spend so much money and dark money to oppose certain candidates for the Corporation Commission and to support others. And I think that was totally unfair to all of those candidates and, frankly, unfair to the ones who won as well. So hopefully that won't become an issue. I don't think it is. I think the two commissioners who were elected, I've had a chance to spend some time with them, are going to be very fair, and they are going to decide this issue on the merits. And when you decide this issue on the merits, you don't start adding large fees to people's bills, solar customers' bills, in the way APS is requesting. So I think that the commission is going to be fair. And, you know, going forward, I certainly hope that APS will reconsider that decision to engage in these commission elections. We should not have utilities participate in corporation commission elections at all.
Former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Chris May is currently an attorney in private practice, also a professor of practice at ASU's O'Connor College of Law. Chris, thanks for fitting us in.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear about how Dreamers respond to Judge Anderson's decision yesterday about in-state tuition. And then later on, we'll hear about a one-woman show about domestic violence. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us for News Hour from the BBC starting today at 1. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now. Sunny skies, 81 degrees in Tucson. It's sunny and 79 in Casa Grande. Cloudy skies, 78 degrees in Yuma. It's partly cloudy and 54 in Flagstaff. Sunny and 63 in Prescott. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on I-10 eastbound, the exit ramp at Baseline Road is now clear. If you're looking for more jazz in Phoenix, Jazz PHX is your source for classic jazz and your connection to the Phoenix jazz scene. It's at jazz.kjzz.org and on your HD radio at 91.5 HD2. Mostly sunny skies in Phoenix right now, and it's 83 degrees at 11:25.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Yesterday, Superior Court Judge Arthur Anderson ruled that young immigrants who qualify for deferred action under an Obama administration policy are eligible for in-state tuition because they're lawfully present in the U.S. That ruling applies to students who attend any of the Maricopa community colleges. This morning, KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block was at Phoenix College as a group of Dreamers held a news conference to talk about Judge Anderson's decision. Jude, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So what kind of feelings did the Dreamers express about that decision?
Well, I think there was a lot of relief and a feeling of real victory and triumph. I talked with Belen Sisa. She's a 21-year-old. She started attending Chandler Gilbert Community College as a political science major in summer of 2013. And the only reason she was able to go to college, she said, was because she was able to get the in-state tuition rate as a DACA student. So she had a lot riding on this judge's decision. She said if he ruled the other way, she would have probably given up her studies. So let's take a listen to what she said.
Yesterday when I found this out, this decision, I cried. That it was crying of happiness, and I was shocked because I just could not believe it. This is a decision that it could change all of our futures.
And she says she hopes to go on to Arizona State University and wants to eventually go to law school and become an immigration attorney. So she has a lot riding on whether or not she can afford community college in the meantime.
How many Dreamers are currently enrolled in the Maricopa Community Colleges, and what are the rates they're paying if in fact, they're not in-state?
Yeah, so the estimate from the Maricopa Community College District is about 1,200 students currently. And the difference is pretty big. For one unit, the difference is in-state tuition, $84 versus $325, mm-hmm. Excuse me.
So we've heard a lot, Jude. In fact, I talked with Mark Killian, of the chair of the Board of Regents recently. Going forward, were there any comments related to what the Board of Regents should do? Because the Board of Regents has been talking about having a rate that is not in-state, not out-of-state, sort of in between. What do people have to say about that today?
Well, I think there was a feeling that this legal precedent, a hope that this legal precedent would translate to all of the community colleges and the three state universities. And there was a lot of calling on the Board of Regents to take that in mind. And we heard from former state senator Alfredo Gutierrez, who's currently a Maricopa Community College District board member. Let's take a listen.
The issue here is whether the Arizona Board of Regents has the courage to now do what is right and stop discriminating against these students. The court has clearly said have legal presence in the United States. So let us ask, let us plead, let us beg that the regents do the right thing. But if they don't, let us be prepared to sue.
And so you heard that he said, if they don't do the right thing, we might be prepared to sue. So that's really interesting. We don't really know how this is going to play out in the courts, though. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, who inherited this lawsuit from Tom Horn, who originally brought it in the first place, I mean, they brought it on the grounds that Arizona voters in 2006 had passed a proposition saying that undocumented students could not get in-state tuition rates. Of course, this ruling says these DACA recipients are legally here, so that law doesn't apply. Brnovich has so far said that through his spokeswoman that the will of the voters is very important to him, and he's weighing all of his legal options, including an appeal. So that's something to watch.
So that what's next question is sort of up in the air. We don't really know yet.
Not yet, but it'll be exciting to see.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
KJZZ is licensed to Rio Salado College, part of the Maricopa County Community College District. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Valley weather's been a little bizarre over the past week or so. Last Friday, Phoenix officially hit 100 degrees for the first time in 2015. Then Sunday night, we had rain, which is pretty rare for May, and temperatures in the early evening on Monday were into the lower 70s. So what's going on, and does it give us any idea about what kind of summer we'll have? Joining me is Randy Cervini, professor of geographical science at ASU. He's also the author of Weather's Greatest Mysteries Solved. Randy, welcome back.
Hey, glad to be here.
So how do you explain what went on based on Friday, 100 degrees, 101 degrees, and then a couple of days later, pretty cool and rainy?
Well, it's actually this pretty cool and rainy that's going to be the norm for the next few weeks. We are in a pattern of strangeness that's associated with El Nino, a warming of the Pacific Ocean. That's been pumping up a lot of moisture into, unfortunately for California, only Arizona and New Mexico have been getting the brunt of this moisture. But we're going to have another storm system come through on Thursday and Friday. Probably won't put any rain, but it'll give us some clouds and some wind over the state. And then there's some chances that next week we could even have some more precipitation coming into the state.
Well, give us this is in context for us. It seems very surprising to someone who's lived here most of my life that May is usually when it starts to get even the average temperature, average high is in the lower 90s already. So even with El Nino in effect, how surprising is this? How rare is this for Arizona in early May?
This is, you're right, that May is typically our most, our driest month, basically. But in this particular situation, we've got some strange wind currents. We've got a situation that is pumping up a lot of tropical moisture into the Gulf of California and into Mexico and into Texas and New Mexico. We're getting some of the edge of that kind of moisture, and it's enough to cause some severe storms today, for example, in Texas. But the problem is that it's not getting over into California, and in terms of the drought, they're the ones that really, really need to have it, and it's just not getting into that area.
Yeah, certainly we have to talk about drought, but is this late for El Nino? Should we have gotten this in March and April, or is May okay?
Actually, we should have gotten this El Nino started last September, but the Pacific Ocean has been acting very oddly for us this year. We had thought that the winter was going to be a really wet winter because of El Nino, but El Nino held off. It didn't get started until actually March. And since that particular time, it's becoming a little bit more organized and a little hotter temperatures in the equatorial Pacific, which is what we gauge in El Nino by. When that happens, particularly as we get hot water off the coast of South America, some of that moisture is able to work its way northward, and that's what helps to power our monsoon. Now, typically, that's not going to happen until July, but because we've got so much moisture, because of the hot waters off of South America, we're kind of getting an advanced taste of maybe what we're going to have later on this summer.
And that advanced taste is nice when the day doesn't have to be 110, and then we cool off to 98 with heavy winds and then whatnot. It's pretty interesting to observe. So if, in fact, the next couple of weeks are like this, all right, you know, you sort of answered this, Randy, but people are really wondering about the summer in terms of, I get the idea of maybe how it affects the monsoon. Does it have any effect, or can we predict whether leading up to the monsoon we'll go up to 115. We may hit record heat. The night times, because of the urban heat island, we're going to have 95 degrees at night. Any way to gauge that kind of thing at this point?
Well, yes, we will be getting up into those higher temperatures, because what happens when we have the monsoon start to form is that in order to drive the circulation, in order to drive the air up into Arizona, we need to have really hot temperatures over the Mojave Desert. That produces low pressure that helps to suck up the moisture from down off the Pacific Ocean. Because it's not yet pumped up that moisture, we get really hot because we don't have any humidity in the air. So what happens is, in latter part of May and June, we'll tend to have really hot temperatures, but as you mentioned, it'll be dry so that we'll cool off in the evenings. As we get into July, what's going to happen is we will stay hot, but because we have the humidity, it's not going to cool off at night.
What are you seeing as far as the drought patterns? When you look at this, obviously, to some of us who haven't lived for over a century, this seems like an incredible drought. I guess when we look at history, maybe it isn't, but when you look at things, when you look at patterns, when you talk to colleagues, how can we tell whether the drought is anywhere close to ending or at least coming back to a more manageable level?
Well, the problem is, of course, that there's a lot of different definitions of drought. That the Salt River Project has a different measure of what drought is based on their water availability than, say, a farmer does who needs to have it in the soil right as he's starting to grow. So when we look at this in terms of how much water we have over the western part of the country right now, the key area still has to be California. That when we look at a drought map, how severe the drought is, we're actually not too bad. We are still in drought, but we're not in what's called exceptional or extreme drought. California is unfortunately in extreme drought, that they are at one of the driest times that they have recently seen in, say, at least the last few decades. And there is, unfortunately, no relief in sight, that they don't get a lot of our monsoon. So the moisture that we're going to get in the summer will help us, but not them.
So, Randy, it's somewhat layman's terms. What happens then, the fact that even the rain we got on Sunday and Monday, did any of that come from California, or did that come up from Mexico? Is there a way for it to have bypassed California? Because it does seem like California is excessively dry.
Yeah, the storm itself came down from the northwest, but the moisture actually is coming up from the south.
Okay.
So it's kind of like I use the analogy in my classes of a bullet and a gun. You need to have both in order to get a storm. You need to have the storm, the gun, but you need to have the ammunition, which is the moisture. And if you can put those together at the right place at the right time, you're going to get a storm.
Well, so let's go forward. How far ahead can we look, and how far are the patterns indicating? Anything you can tell us about? I know people want to get past the summer as fast as possible, Randy. Any thoughts about how wet our fall might be? Is it possible to look that far ahead?
Well, the Climate Prediction Center, one, is saying that we're going to have a fairly active monsoon, that particularly the area of northern Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah should actually get quite a bit of storms this particular summer. As we get into the fall, it's going to depend on whether this El Nino intensifies or whether it stays in its kind of low-grade type of situation that it was for most of the winter. We did get a little bit of precipitation. If El Nino strengthens over the summer and into the fall, this actually could be a pretty wet winter.
So if El Nino arrives in September or May, it doesn't matter as long as we get some precipitation, I suppose.
Right.
Randy Servini, professor of geographical science at ASU, is also the author of Weather's Greatest Mystery Solved. Randy, we always appreciate you coming in. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out how should we react when a celebrity, an athlete, musician does something we don't like off the stage or off the court. Can we still like them? We'll find out next. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Tempe Coalition, drawing attention to the value of parents talking to their teens. 40% of youth report the reason they don't drink is because their parents would be disappointed in them. TempeCoalition.org.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on the northbound State Route 51, watch out for a crash in the left lanes at Indian School Road. Valley forecast calling for partly sunny skies today, a high near 88 degrees. It'll be sunny tomorrow with a high of 85 and then dropping to 78 degrees by Friday. We've got NPR's Here and Now starting at 12 o'clock. Today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is scrambling to form a coalition government or be forced to step down. And Californians are about to be hit by mandatory water restrictions. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Mostly sunny skies right now in the valley. We've got 20% relative humidity, and it's 83 degrees at 11:38.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last weekend, boxing fans and others were treated to the so-called fight of the century between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. Some people who had looked forward to watching it were still a little hesitant because of the personal lives of the fighters, Mayweather in particular because he served time for domestic violence. Should we be willing to spend time and money on celebrities, athletes, actors, or musicians who make offstage or off-field decisions we don't respect? Lawrence Rubin is a Florida-based psychologist and a contributor to Psychology Today. He explains why many of us are drawn to celebrities in the first place.
Well, I think the two sort of become indistinguishable at some point. You know, the more hype, the more we believe that these lives of others are important, relevant to our own lives, models for our own day-to-day existence. I think it's sort of hard to throw out the baby with the bathwater or vice versa. So I think both are real. For some people, the lives of celebrities are much more important and poignant than to others. To other people, the lives of celebrity provide, I think, a sense of, I don't know, glimpse into the powerful, glimpse into the infinite, glimpse into the possible, that perhaps their day-to-day lives don't provide them.
Do you think celebrities, regardless whether it's an actor, musician, athlete, do you think there's a feeling that the public in general wants to view those people in real people terms, or do you think we want to put them on a pedestal?
I think it bridges the gap. I think when you see a multi-quadrillionaire sitting at home, you know, with their babies on their laps, or, you know, on a couch like you or I have, you know, if you sort of disregard the fact that, you know, behind the camera there's a 45-room house and 13 cars, I think it bridges the distance. I think sometimes people like to believe that there's something bigger, that the opulence is real and it's obtainable. I think it gives them a way to sort of leap out of their own lives for a minute and consider. Joseph Campbell, the historian, said, you know, mythology gives us an opportunity to glimpse the infinite. And I think that, you know, these opulent lives of celebrities are just that. That these seem to be limitless people with limitless resources. And wouldn't it be nice to think that I could be that, or at least I can drop in on their lives and I can have that, you know. Well, sometimes it's just plain voyeurism. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, elevating these celebrities and then tearing them down, I think if we go by the media, and you know, the media, I think, is a reflection of us. If we didn't consume it, it wouldn't exist. It almost seems that we have as strong a need to dethrone the heroes as we do to enshrine them.
So in that sense, whether it's the process of someone tearing someone else down or someone being caught in a compromising position, you know, there are some people who wonder about or feel guilt in some sense of saying, well, can I still like that person's music? Can I still watch that person on a basketball court? Is that a common feeling, a common thought, and what do you make of it?
I think it's hard. I think it's hard sometimes for people to separate the two. You know, the person who's done good for many but has also had, you know, a flawed life, or a person who has benefited society and then also has betrayed society. I think it's tough for people to reconcile, and maybe it is easier for them to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But then again, that's part of our, I think, our curiosity, our lurid curiosity for the lives of these people. The more we demand to know about them, the more we're going to get just what we demand. We demand to see that these people are real. So we've sort of enlisted an army of propagandists and public and journalists to go after and find us the lurid stuff so we can tear them down. I think there's a hunger. You know, if you look at the number of books and articles and documentaries and interviews of these flawed heroes, you'll find they're almost as great probably as the interviews of the untouched heroes. So I think it's, again, it's just a love-hate relationship.
Is there some advice you would give to someone who's gotten so caught up in a celebrity or someone that they're affected? Can you actually talk to someone and say, you know, well, kind of what did you expect? In some ways, they're going to have the same flaws that you're going to have. Would you act right in a different way if you were on this kind of pedestal?
Yeah, I guess my advice to folks who are so obsessed by others, who, you know, live on every tweet of every celebrity, to, I guess, have the courage to take a look at your own lives and look at its strengths and look at its flaws and make sense of your own existence, because you're sure as hell never going to make sense of someone else's, especially who you don't know or will never have access to. I wonder sometimes if people run away from their own lives and hide in the lives of others, because sometimes it's just not easy to take a look at ourselves and say, oi, this didn't turn out the way I wanted it, or I'm not the person I thought I was going to be.
Florida-based psychologist Lawrence Rubin, a contributor to Psychology Today. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In addition to learning how to emotionally distance ourselves from the celebrities we follow, there are other questions that keep coming up in this realm. Specifically, what happens when you really like something that's problematic? As we mentioned with Dr. Rubin, some people experience that in deciding whether or not to watch last weekend's boxing match between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. Joining me now to talk about how to tease this out is Tassara Dudley. She recently wrote an article for the site Black Girl Dangerous titled, Your Fave is Problematic, Loving Media That Doesn't Love You Back. She's also an activist and founder of Morning Glory Publishing. Tassara, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
So can we keep loving that problematic media, or should we feel guilty or ashamed or anything like that?
Well, I think for me, guilt is not a particularly helpful emotion. I think in part of the work that I do in activism, there's a lot of focus on feeling your feelings, but also like moving into action. So I think guilt prevents that. I think when we're talking about loving problematic media or figures such as Mayweather, mm-hmm. I think it sort of comes to me, it comes down to holding accountability. I think it's fine to continue loving things as long as we're willing to critique them, because it gets really hairy when we are not willing to critique those things.
Is that critiquing in some form kind of a venting for ourselves in addition to being an activist about it? If someone can say, if you're sort of trying to convince yourself that there isn't an issue with that problematic media, is that worse than deciding to critique it?
Well, it's definitely very disingenuous. I think it is a problem to not be willing to critique things. People have tried to hold Mayweather accountable, to ask him about the sort of accusations against him, and he's very much blown it off, and that's the point where I would say he doesn't need your money if you are in favor of supporting battered women, and I would hope that we are, then we don't need to support people with our money that are not willing to do better.
What are some examples for you that have been a little bit tough that you've written about, maybe some favorite shows that you have that at times make you squirm a little bit?
Well, in the Black Girl Dangerous piece, I mentioned Supernatural, and that's definitely one of them.
And tell people a little bit more about Supernatural. That's on the CW, a couple of brothers who were involved in some stuff. Some of us don't know that much about the program. Give us an idea of the background on it and then why you were troubled by some of it.
Yeah, well, Supernatural started out as sort of like a horror show. There's some monster of the week, some of the jump scare suspense angle. It's gotten into this sort of overarching long plot, but basically the two brothers are monster hunters, and they travel around the United States primarily, hunting monsters and protecting people. But there's some running jokes that are really problematic. One of them has this obsession with this pornographic magazine called Busty Asian Babes or something like that. Okay. That comes up every so often, and it's supposed to be a laugh, but it's really problematic in the way that it objectifies women.
Do you think it matters whether a program is a comedy or a drama or a fantasy horror kind of program, or do we have to think about what the creators were thinking about as they try to put in maybe some subtle cues as they go about their business?
I don't think genre necessarily matters, because we'll find some of the same tropes across genres. Like if we're talking about representation of trans women in media, police procedurals have a really terrible history with trans women characters, but also you find that same terrible history in other kinds of media as well, in horror, things like that. And I think, well, the creator's intentions are not to be oppressive, I think that what matters is the impact they have on people.
What do you think about the argument that some would make that, it's entertainment, I'm going to turn off my brain and I'm going to worry about real life in another sense and become an activist in that? Or again, do you think that what we're seeing on the screen reflects so much of society that we can't ignore it, even if our first priority there is to be entertained?
Yeah, definitely that second one. People may feel like they're turning off their brains, but we're taking those media messages in, whether we are conscious of that or not. And when it comes to representation of various marginalized and oppressed people, those people see those things, and it contributes to stuff like disparate health outcomes, high rates of suicide, things like that. Like, these people are seeing these representations on TV, and they're taking them in, and that's telling them what society feels about them, and it's really damaging.
Finally, do you think devoting more attention to this kind of thing is going to make creators more willing to try different things? I mean, Orange is the New Black is one that gets a lot of attention for having a real diverse cast. Is that the sort of thing we're going to see more of as people are more aware of our diverse population?
I hope so. We still see, for instance, with Jeremy Renner and Chris Evans, they made a gaffe in an interview around the Avengers. We still see that, those sort of insular communities, but they were willing to apologize and hopefully do better next time. And I really think that a lot of creators are starting to realize the impact they're having in society, and they're listening to fans. And I think that's really important and valuable, and I hope it continues.
Tessara Dudley recently wrote an article for the site Black Girl Dangerous called Your Fave is Problematic, Loving Media That Doesn't Love You Back. She's also an activist and founder of Morning Glory Publishing. Tessara, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Abusive marriages and domestic violence are not topics that are typically entertaining. They're also unlikely to induce side-splitting laughter. That's one of the challenges for writer and performer Laurel Ann Porter, who just completed her PhD at ASU. Tonight at 7 at the Phoenix Youth Hostel and Cultural Center, she'll perform her one-woman show, How Not to Make Love to a Woman. Porter told me she wanted it to feel like doing stand-up comedy, which was one of her greatest fears as a performer.
It was an interesting process because it's a difficult topic, because I left an abusive marriage. But I also felt it never got to the point of bruises or broken bones or you know, anything life-threatening. And so there were times when I thought, well, gosh, my story's really not that bad. You know, what could it possibly say to folks who have gone through things much worse than I had? So I did the piece in a workshop setting, and people came up to me and they said, gosh, we don't really know whether we should laugh or cry, which, you know, for me, is kind of great. I'm always interested in, I'm interested in laughter. I'm interested in the moments of laughter, particularly that are uncomfortable. And I think oftentimes there are moments of laughter that can indicate something about how we think about something or how we process things. Mm-hmm. One of the courses that I took was a course in critical autoethnography. Ethnography is kind of the telling of someone's culture, and autoethnography is telling the story of our own culture. And the critical part of it is what really finally kind of interested me and finally brought the piece, I think, to its full sort of the state it is right now. Because the critical questions that I started asking were not necessarily how bad the story was, and that actually wasn't really a story that I was interested in telling, mm-hmm. but I was very interested in trying to kind of poke at what are the beliefs and assumptions and narratives that have played out in my life repeatedly that may have contributed to me finding myself in that position. Mm-hmm. And so it became more a matter of questioning how it is that I arrived at that point. And part of that process also was looking at, oh, what are the red flags that I ignored? Because I think a lot of us, we go into a new relationship, of course we think it's going to be beautiful and wonderful, and we don't think at the beginning that it's going to end up being abusive or even unhealthy. And so I don't know how everybody is, but I know that for me, it takes a lot to finally admit that, oh, that was a red flag, and that was a red flag, and that was a red flag, and I chose to ignore those. And then, so part of the critical autoethnography process was to ask myself, why did I ignore those? And so this piece has become much more about kind of finding a place of healing, but also understanding how I got there. Mm-hmm. And so some of that is kind of self-forgiveness. Some of that is releasing some of the bitterness.
There's got to be that fine line you're walking where you want to make sure that you're expressing what's really inside of you, and you want people to take, I mean, as you said, situations can be funny and painful at the same time. So how do you reach the balance where you're happy with it, where you feel like not only is this entertaining, it's important, but it's also not entertaining in a slight way where people can sort of laugh it off and then they're not really impacted when they leave the theater.
The piece has grown. And the piece has grown probably because I have also grown. I use this idea of the top 10 lists, kind of like David Letterman does.
Okay, yeah.
And so that became a way to really approach it in a lighthearted way. There's about three scenes in there that take the top 10 list. One of them actually is the 10 chances. So for whatever reason, in my mind, when I was in my marriage, I thought, oh, once I started realizing what the red flags were, I said, okay, I'll give him 10 before I leave. Which, you know, I told my mother later, and she was heartbroken. She said, well, why should you give anybody one chance? But I think it's, for whatever reason, there's an attachment to the person. You feel like you want to kind of try to work things out.
It's a person you've loved and you want to devote this energy to.
This is a person I loved, right? I had a child with him. Mm-hmm. And so there definitely became, you know, this top 10 list became a possibility for both laughter and also to kind of critically examine what's going on. The other thing that has been important through the development of this piece is that I have to be really careful. Some of the criticism I've gotten is that some people think, oh, these are definitely trigger moments, and that if an audience comes in not knowing what this is about or not realizing, they can be triggered, and that can be, you know, something that is not necessarily the most ethical way to go about things. So I ended up just making it very clear in the title, How Not to Make Love to a Woman, an almost comedy about domestic violence. So I put right in the title that this is about domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So if folks are going to be triggered by that, they already know. They can kind of come in prepared. And the opening of the piece does ask some pretty stark questions to the audience. And the image that folks see when they walk in is also a little bit stark. And so it has very different shifts in tones. So when you ask, you know, how do I come to the right tone? There are definitely places where sometimes the tone folks have described as sort of risque performance art, and then other times the tone is very just kind of me telling stories. I also sing, so there are some songs involved.
How do you decide that I am this confident performer, but at the same time, without turning people away, there has to be at the heart of it the example as to why I'm even performing this show?
I think what I do, or what I try to do in my work, is establish the kind of vulnerability in me as a performer that sets the stage, as it were, for audiences to come in and realize I'm putting myself on the line here in a way. I'm exposing myself, and folks that will come see the show will see. I do, at the very beginning of the piece, I put myself out there in a way that actually is kind of risky. If I'm not careful, someone could come up and hurt me. But I think it's important to establish, and it's something you can't really establish verbally. It's a gesture. The act of putting myself out there in a vulnerable state allows audience members to come in and realize, okay, so this is someone who's deliberately willing to put herself in a vulnerable position, so that there can be some kind of mutual understanding for those other people who have found themselves in a kind of vulnerable situation, most of the time in ways that didn't end up so well. So once we've established that we're here in a shared moment of vulnerability, then I can tell you my story.
Before I let you go, I guess I have to ask how you arrived at the title, because it can have multiple meanings. When people first hear that title, they can laugh about it and they could say, well, ugh. Boy, did that really stem from something that was pretty lousy. I mean, that wasn't something you and your former husband actually, like, you never actually used that phrase to him.
No. Okay. No, we never used that phrase.
Like, wow, you were really so terrible. That was how not to make love to a woman.
Right, exactly. You are the pristine example. That's where it does get sort of awkward and strange, in that some of the red flags were actually sexual.
Hmm.
So some of the red flags were... I was always, most of my life, a very happy sexual person. And some of the red flags that I later identified as red flags were kind of shutting me down. So after a few gestures that I thought were basically examples of him trying to establish control, not in a way that was a healthy intimacy, so if you'll pardon the crassness, it is true, how not to make love to a woman, you know, we can't deny when we're in an intimate relationship like that, there are sexual dynamics involved. Mm-hmm.
Laurel Ann Porter, she'll be performing her one-woman show, How Not to Make Love to a Woman, at Almost Comedy About Domestic Violence, at 7 o'clock tonight at the Phoenix Youth Hostel and Cultural Center in downtown Phoenix. It's for mature audiences only. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. And thank you very much for listening. If you missed one of our interviews or want to catch up with a past program, go to kjzz.org later this afternoon. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone and follow us on Twitter at KJZZ Here and Now. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix in HD. I'm Steve Goldstein.